This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. And as you probably know, stuff happens, and it's happening right now. And it has some impact on the New Books Network, or more particularly on the following interview. It was conducted in Shanghai. And as you know, things in Shanghai are a bit difficult right now, what with the coronavirus and all. And so the interview itself was conducted in a restaurant where I'm sure the host and the guests had a fine meal. I've done my best to clean up the audio. I think it's pretty good. I hope you enjoy it.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Keith Kruger, and today we're fortunate to be joined by the authors of an interesting and timely new book that makes the case for the value of social hierarchy. The book's title, Just Hierarchy, Why Social Hierarchies Matter in China and the Rest of the World, was written by Daniel Bell and Pei Wang and published just this year by Princeton University Press. Professors Bell and Wang, both political theorists living and teaching in China, draw on interdisciplinary sources and point out in all their arguments the challenges posed by their recommendations and the political system within which they work. This is familiar territory for Bell, who has written books over the past three decades on various related topics, from communitarianism to political meritocracy and democratic thinking, within comparative East-West perspectives. Careful readers will note that his prior work, from Beyond Liberal Democracy and China's New Confucianism, to name a few, laid the groundwork for the more widely read 2015 The China Model, subtitled Political Meritocracy and the Limits of Democracy. In the 2016 new preface for the paperback edition of that work, he wrote, "Method matters because the question of which ideals should be used to evaluate the political reality is a political choice." This is a point Professor Bell continues to make about his work, including the new book, co-authored with Professor Wang, that we're here to talk about today. Pei and Daniel, welcome and thanks for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thanks for having us.
Sure. And it should be pointed out that we're meeting at a downtown eatery in Shanghai where semi-quarantine conditions have been in effect for over a month and local schools have switched to online delivery of classes. Many businesses remain closed, and people continue to take personal precautions, with the government hoping that recent containment efforts won't suffer setbacks due to returning citizens and foreign workers from outside the country. So, direct this to you guys. Hey, what has life been like for you both, and how have you both stayed busy?
Well, it's a good opportunity to read and write. I mean, as dean, I'm more of an administrator. And because most of the university is shut down except for online teaching, we have less administration. To the extent we have meetings, they're online now, so more efficient. And to be frank, although I hope this isn't made public to my colleagues, we can do other stuff while the meetings are take place, whereas if they were live, it's not so easy.
And we're preparing the Chinese edition of the book Just Hierarchy during this spring.
And you both teach Daniel Yu at Shandong University and Pei Yu in Shanghai.
In Fudan University.
Sure. Okay. Hey, your book makes the argument for social hierarchies and in a number of forms, structured through its five chapters. Hey, which parts do you guys think are most relevant to our current moment?
Well, so we distinguish between bad hierarchies that are ossified and that serve the powerful and oppress the powerless, and good hierarchies that are different in nature depending on the social relation. So in chapter two, we ask what's a good hierarchy between rulers and citizens. And the hierarchies can be justified if the rulers serve the people in an efficient and able way. And if we use that kind of criterion, arguably the beginning of this epidemic was a failure in China, whereby the conscientious professionals who should be respected because of their training, I mean, that's a legitimate hierarchy, who wanted to serve the community, but their views were not allowed to be expressed. I mean, they were, we can call them whistleblowers, and their views were muffled. And as a result of that, the epidemic was allowed to propagate itself, and arguably that helped to spawn this global pandemic. That said, since then, the government has done, we can call it a seemingly good job, in the sense that now in Shanghai and the rest of China, we're basically almost free of the virus, but the rest of the world isn't. In fact, the rest of the world is getting much worse. So there's a kind of, we can call it a seemingly good hierarchy, where the government can mobilize resources with the support, the central government can mobilize resources with the support of local government and dutiful citizens in a way that might not be possible in countries that lack this kind of political hierarchy.
Yeah, and also in chapter five, we discuss the relation between human and robots. And we think during this epidemic, if we could use more robots to help patients with food and medicine, it would be much easier for those the nurses and doctors. They could concentrate more on other like patients. And also, we saw there are so many.
The drones.
They use drones to spread medicine.
Yeah.
To keep the residents clean, and also they use drones to warn people wear masks when you're walking outside.
Right.
So here we saw so many new high technique applying for everyday life, and we hope in the future we could see more robots that could serve human beings.
Yeah, so in chapter five, we argue that a legitimate hierarchy between humans and intelligent machines, we're a bit blunt. We say that machines are there to serve us, almost like slaves, and that's a good thing. I mean, if robots can help in hospitals or drones can help supply medicines and so on, but we do worry that at some point, intelligent machines will become so intelligent that they'll surpass humans in most abilities. And at that point, we need to worry that the hierarchies could be inversed with us as slaves and the machines as masters.
Yeah, and also we think the relation between human and machine couldn't surpass the relation between, like, intimacy could surpass the relation among families. Because we saw so many cute little robots that people were so fond of them. And we were so worried that prefer the caring robots, cute caring robots, than their children. That's not something we're going to like to see.
So in countries that strongly prioritize filial piety, like China, we think it's important for adult children to care for their elderly parents. But if you have cute robots who replace or who replace adult children in terms of the affections of the elderly parents. We think that's worrisome. So it's not we're not joking. We argue that from a public policy point of view, in countries that value filial piety, it should be ugly robots that serve elderly parents, because elderly parents are less likely to be attached to elderly robots.
Is that the argument then, or that's the distinction that you guys make between Marxist and Confucian ethics?
Yeah, so we argue that both Marxist and Confucian ethics should inform the way that we think of intelligent machines. And the Marxist view basically is that Marx is a technological optimist. He thought that machines would develop to the point where they're so intelligent and so creative that they could do most of the socially necessary work, and thus humans would be free to realize their creative abilities without doing dirty and dangerous work. And we think that's a good ideal to pursue, and we think that machines can and should be used for this purpose. But Marx didn't anticipate the possibility that machines could be so smart that they could displace humans and make us into the slaves. So we think that Marx argued that at some point in higher communism, the state would wither away, because at that point everybody would be equal, machines would do the socially necessary work, and there's no need anymore for coercive government. But we argue that because of the possibility that intelligent machines could become so intelligent that make us into the slaves, we need a strong government to prevent that eventuality from happening. And the state, it will never wither away, basically. So Marx is wrong about that. But meanwhile, I mean, that's decades away, hopefully, maybe longer, hopefully it'll never happen. But meanwhile, we think that Confucian ethics has a lot to offer to think about how to design intelligent machines, whether it's caring robots or self-driving cars. We think Confucian values has a lot to offer. And we give examples. I mean, we mentioned already the caring robots, but for self-driving cars, you know, what are the values that should be programmed in self-driving cars? And Confucian strongly prioritized the values of, in English it sounds negative, deference. In Chinese, rang, you know, it's more like being polite to people, being cordial. And if those sorts of values can be programmed in self-driving cars, we think it would also help to, let's say, upgrade the civility among people at large.
Yeah, chapter 5 is a key chapter, and the one that you guys really closed the book with. You open it with Marx's The Fragment on Machines, and again that leads into this master-slave relation. So you guys are right to point out the question of which ethics do you program into these machines. I read that you had visited Silicon Valley and had some experience there. What can you share some of that with us?
Well, there was a meeting at Stanford where there were not just ethicists. Actually, it was a meeting between ethicists and some very successful entrepreneurs as well as scientists. And none of them seemed to be aware of, except those who directly work on Chinese philosophy, of the possibility that Confucian ethics may have something to contribute. I mean, but what really worried me, especially speaking to some very wealthy and successful entrepreneurs and inventors, I mean, they thought that we're at some point, for sure, intelligent robots or intelligent machines are going to displace humans, and we're going to become at some point their servants, if not their slaves. So they're thinking of fleeing to other planets as a kind of way of planning to get away from this situation. I thought that was pretty scary, to be frank. And also just from a kind of, you know, let's call it socialist or liberal egalitarian point of view. I mean, the idea that a few billionaires can get away while leaving us here, the rest to be the slaves of their intelligent machines, that didn't sound like a very attractive scenario as well. I mean, the good side, I guess, is that some of them were saying that we're becoming vegetarians now because we want to treat animals and plants in a kind way, the way that we expect to be treated once those intelligent machines become masters over us.
And you cover that a bit in chapter 4.
Right. So the basic argument in our book about what counts as a legitimate hierarchy is that it depends on the social relation. I mean, there's no universal principle. So the relation between machines and humans is more, we argue, should be a kind of master-slave relation where we're the masters and there are slaves. But with animals, it's different, right? Animals have feeling. Animals can suffer, and arguably they have also some form of consciousness. So therefore, we can't treat them like slaves. But on the other hand, they're not the equals of humans. I mean, if we have to choose in cases of conflict, you know, we're going to choose to save a human. I mean, there's a famous case in a Cincinnati zoo where this child fell into a cage with a gorilla and had to choose between killing the gorilla and killing the child, the six-year-old child, and they chose to kill the gorilla. I mean, of course, it's a tragedy, but it's not somebody that, I think even the strongest defender of animal rights won't argue that he should have killed the child instead. In fact, Peter Singer, who's famous for his defense of animal rights, because he said we shouldn't, you know, he's saying basically in those cases of conflict, he almost acknowledged that, yeah, at that point, humans should have priority. But, so then what should be the principle? Well, we argue that it should be subordination without cruelty, that we should never be cruel to animals, no matter what kind of animal, no matter how ugly the animal, even towards cockroaches. Maybe we have to kill them for some hygienic reason, but we still shouldn't be cruel to them. You know, and there was a case of in the Philippines where an artist showed a photographer of a cockroach in an electric chair and being killed in a very cruel way. I mean, that was to make a point about, against a capital punishment for humans, but it still is wrong to treat even a cockroach in that way. So in chapter four, we developed this view that the principle informing our relation with humans should be subordination without cruelty. And then we argue in more detail that it depends on the kind of animal. Within that kind of general principle, there's still even more specific principles. Like, for example, if it's pets who spend a lot of time with us, then we owe them much more than just refraining from cruelty. We owe them stronger obligations than that.
You bookend that chapter with reference to Descartes' cruel animal experiments. And can you share some of that and Voltaire's response to extend your point that animals are not machines?
Yeah, well, I mean, Descartes, he treated animals strictly. He viewed them as machines who were incapable of feeling. And he performed, or at least allowed, some experiments, very cruel experiments against animals. And if you think that animals don't suffer, then it's no big deal. But Voltaire was critical of that, saying, no, are you kidding? Animals suffer, and we should treat them in a way that, in a way that refrains from cruelty. So, of course, we think Voltaire was on the right side of history.
Well, we've been kind of going at this in reverse. We didn't start with the early chapters, but jumped right into the last two. Hey, do you guys want to go back a little bit to the beginning? And do you want to maybe differentiate between just hierarchies and unjust hierarchies?
So unjust hierarchies are easier to identify. They all have the same structure. They're basically hierarchies that are fixed. They're ossified. And that serve the powerful and oppress those on the bottom of hierarchies. So, for example, racism, you know, they're basically fixed, right? Once you identify a race as superior to others, it's very hard to change. And then they apply, and then they benefit the races that are on top and oppress those that are on bottom. And other hierarchies like
sexism. I mean, very famous from Aristotle, like infamous from Aristotle, saying like women are inferior to men. But we all know it's wrong.
Yeah, and he regarded women as biologically inferior to men. That's something that you can change. And obviously, that's the wrong sort of hierarchy. Or the way of thinking about the Indian caste system, at least in its kind of stereotypical form. I mean, some scholars argue that it's more the influence of the West that it became a stereotypical form. But anyway, you know, that you have certain castes that are fixed for eternity and that have more power than others. And that, we argue, is fundamentally unjust. So those are easier to identify. And also, if you think of the history, I mean, in the West, the way that we think of the past, we think of, oh, it's generally these traditional fixed hierarchies where you had aristocratic white men who were dominant against the rest, and we had to liberate ourselves from that by affirming the value of social equality. So it's a kind of natural way of thinking if you're from a Western country that the past represents hierarchy, which is bad, and the good and the modernity represents social equality, which is good. But the Chinese kind of way of thinking about history, I think, is somewhat different. Maybe you want to say a little bit about hierarchies in China that were viewed as more progressive, so to speak.
Yes, and one of the most important criticism on your earlier book, China Model, is that hierarchy leads to this ossified structure of society. But as long as I did a little research on Chinese history on this meritocratic system, I feel that every time when people, when those literatize called for a meritocracy, it was not the high time for meritocracy. It's basically the low time for meritocracy because they need more capable and a virtuous person at court. So that's why literatize like doing this advocate on meritocracy. So in the very beginning, they choose government officials by recommendation. So they put it as recommendation system. Everything is like Han Dynasty. But after that, people feel that, oh, now the control for this recommendation was held to several big families. So after that, we have this 9 ranking system. So the power to recommend public officials generally moves from big families to local governors, so they can recommend people. And after that, when 9 rank system got ossified again, we have this very famous imperial examination system. That's why that's how people can no matter where you're from, a big family, a very rich noble family, or just you from, they call it a Hanmen, like a very poor family. As long as you can read, write, and do articles, you can go for the imperial exam system, exam. And if you have a like good article and you can press the emperor, you can have a job at court. So, but still, even after that, the exam system still got a little bit ossified because people feel they have this capacity, they're very capable, competent, but they somehow lack virtue. So there are some literature in Song Dynasty, Zhu Xi, and he said probably we should like revive this recommendation system. No, he didn't call it recommendation system, but recommendation. To recommend someone who are very virtuous and among his classmates, and to get a job at court, because if there are so many capable official government but without virtue, it's going to be very easy to corruption. So basically, the system for select and promote capable and virtuous people in Chinese history often like correct itself during this process. So we saw this as a...
So basically, the idea of political hierarchy is not so pejorative if you think of Chinese history, that it's always been held as an ideal, and people recognize that political hierarchies are bad when they become ossified, and it's precisely in those periods when thinkers affirm new forms of hierarchy. But they defended this idea of political hierarchy on the basis of everybody should have equal opportunity to become to become a public official. And we need to think of new institutions that are more meritocratic that allow for that to happen. So there's not this view like in the West where hierarchy is, I mean, to be a bit crude or very crude, that hierarchy is the past and it's bad and modernity means equality and it's good. In Chinese history, this idea of there's always been distinction between the good and the bad forms of hierarchy. And in politics, the ideal of political meritocracy has been used to critique ossified, to critique bad forms of hierarchy. So it has a different ring in Chinese history compared to Western history. I mean, this is a gross oversimplification, but I think it's general tendencies that still inform the way people think. Of course, having said that, I mean, in Chinese, the term for hierarchy, dongji, is just as pejorative as the English term.
Yeah.
But in terms of everyday social practice, there's much more, let's say, allowance and sometimes even celebration of social hierarchy, not just in China but in other countries influenced by Confucian culture, including Korea and Japan. So, So, and there's different terminology in Chinese that maybe allows us to think about hierarchy,
yeah,
not just
like,
in a negative
example,
way, but
like
in a positive way.
Some way.
Yeah.
Position, proper position. So the story can go on from like Zhou Dynasty. It's several thousand years before the
Common Era.
Common Era, mm-hmm. Yes. And there is like a ritual of Zhou Dynasty. They rank different people according to their like a position. So, but you have to have the corresponding virtue to get to that position. So there is a accordance between the position and the virtue, the position and capacity.
Yeah.
So it was a very like ancient idea.
Yeah.
But every time when in Chinese history, when people call for like we want more new talent in the court, they will use this as a principle. That if your virtue, your capacity is not suitable for your position, you have to get out of your position, right? Like left it open, empty for someone else who is more suitable for this.
Right.
So in China, it's a little bit strange because when we are talking about new and old, it's a little bit different from Western people. When Western people will say like, hierarchy is old and equality is new. But in China, it's not like that. Sometimes we will use new old ideas to give a revolution. So that's why, especially in Qing Dynasty, Kang Youwei, he just used Confucius. He reinterpreted Confucius as a revolutionist.
Yeah, and there was a revolution in Confucianism. I mean, even though he claimed he wasn't doing original thought. But what does it mean to be, he used the term junzi, which we can translate sometimes as noble person, or as exemplary person. But before him, to be an exemplary, to be a nobleman, so to speak, was a more kind of aristocrat in a kind of Western sense. If you're born into a rich or wealthy family, you're a junzi. And he says, no, to be a junzi, you have to have superior ability and especially superior virtue. So that was 2,500 years ago, a very positive view of hierarchy, where it's grounded on superior ability and virtue, not on what family you're born in or how much money or power you have.
Well, that kind of leads us into, hey, so what are the practical problems of implementing political meritocracy?
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Well, so in a modern era, obviously we need to combine the ideal of political meritocracy with democracy. I mean, on the one hand, it's good that political system should aim to select and choose public officials with above average ability and virtue. Seems to me it's kind of obvious. I mean, who would want to be ruled by a stupid person or by a corrupt person, right? I mean, maybe some people have that desire, but just to me it just seems irrational. But on the other hand, we also want to give some sort of political say to ordinary people. So the question is, how do we reconcile those ideals? So in China now, I think both political meritocracy and democracy need to be improved. So in Chapter 2, we have a lot on how to improve political meritocracy, especially dealing with corruption. But we also have a quite extensive section on how to promote democratic forms of government without elections at the very top. Because we think that one of the advantages of political meritocracy at the top is that leaders could plan for the long term. Leaders all have some sort of political experience, so they won't make beginners' mistakes. So we should preserve those advantages of political meritocracy. But then we also should have many forms of democratic participation short of one person, one vote to select rulers at the very top, for example.
We have this civil sortition according to the study of Hu Baogang. We studied this local village, and they used sortition to
do random sampling sortition. Lottery system.
To help the local government to do the budget. I remember. In the time of Mao Zedong, Chairman Mao, he said we have to the party should use a mass line to get to know people. And nowadays, mass line has become like online mass line. So government could take suggestions online. There is one website that everyone can write suggestions. And also, Xi Jinping himself even said our officials should not be afraid to get online, to hear what people's requests or the criticism from the people. And if they're saying something right, we have to take the advice from the people. And also we have this community building as well. Like in Shanghai, the classification of garbage, I think this is a new tide for local residents, local communities to build their own spirit, because people are so in Shanghai, people are so proud of this city, and people are so proud of that Shanghai, this city, is the first city in China truly realize this classification of garbage.
And when you say that, you mean recycling it?
And source of work, like first of all, you have to separate different kind of garbage. It's not easy for Chinese people, and for Shanghai there are different areas, and some areas were the first to implement that, and people living there feel quite proud of this, and they even form this local community spirit out of this. We think
so basically we should be open to many forms of democratic participation at lower levels. Could include elections, but many other forms of participation, including sortition, including local mass line, modernized mass line, could be local community participation. We think there's still a long way to go, but at least the potential is there.
Sure. And I would think one of the things that we bump up against, or you guys bump up against, and with regard to your arguments, is that you guys address this, that you need to justify this hierarchical political system outside this system. And the question I'm trying to get to is, hey, which ideals would you use as the criteria then?
So if we, basically in China, there's a huge organization, the Communist Party, with about 90 million members. And so how do you justify that sort of political hierarchy to people who are outside the system, who are non-members, so to speak? And this is where we think that there's many ways of providing for participation short of being member of the ruling party. It was my co-author just mentioned things like local community activities or being selected by the sortition to provide advice, if not help to rule on some local issues. But at the end of the day, the big problem with the kind of mainstream political culture in China, which owes much to Confucianism, is this idea that the best life involves serving the community as a public official. And so long as that will be held as the standard of what counts as the best life, I think there's going to always be some sort of feeling of inadequacy or maybe even resentment among those who don't have the, let's say, opportunity or equal opportunity to participate in politics. So it's very important to provide a sense of, or to just change that conception of what counts as the best life, that, so that there's a more plural view of what counts as the best life. I mean, people who are who do good work in the family, as caring for elderly parents or for children, people who through religious organizations do good work, people who, the public healthcare workers now, I mean, in Wuhan, I mean, who leads a better life than them? I mean, you know, these are, so we need to allow for the possibility that there are many forms of different admirable forms of life. And on the one hand, it relieves some pressure on the political system. But on the other hand, I think it is also a true thing that we should allow for the possibility, you know, we should recognize that being in politics is not the only, is not the best form of life. And that's where we appeal to the Taoist critique of Confucianism, because the Taoists were always very critical of this kind of Confucian view that the best life lies in serving the community and we should all compete to be the best sworn public official. And we say there's resources in Taoism that allow us to question this kind of Confucian view of what counts as the best life.
Yeah, they will think that the best form of life is to feel yourself truly to be a part of the nature, to feel this harmony in the nature. And as people living in city, I think the easiest and the best way for them is raising a cute little dog. And we can see in Shanghai, the most probably feminist city in China. We saw so many cute little dogs wearing different colorful suits, boots, and scarves.
And this culture of cuteness, in a way, is a form of rebellion against this political meritocracy, which ultimately, in a modern society, needs a very strict, hierarchical, bureaucratic system, and often male-oriented. But this is a kind of form of rebellion against political meritocracy, which we think is a good thing. I mean, on the one hand, it questions its view that the best form of life is this kind of being a top public official. On the other hand, it's kind of playful and, to be frank, relieve some pressure on the political system. I mean, if people derive meaning from this kind of more playful, maybe we can form of life, caring for cute little dogs, then that's a good thing as well.
Well, you worked us really back into, it's a nice segue really back to the beginning of the book. And one thing I had wanted to ask you guys about was, you mentioned the term nighttime hierarchies. Does anyone want to?
Well, so the basic principle, again, is that the negative hierarchies are easy to identify, pretty much have the same kind of underlying structure, fixed, serve the powerful, oppress the powerless. But the good hierarchies all have different forms, and we need to think about the social relation and then think about what is the relevant principle that justifies hierarchical principles in those social relations. So in the case of hierarchy between intimates, it could be family intimates or any sort of intimate face-to-face relation, we argue that those hierarchies need to be characterized by shifting roles. If they're always the same with one person on top, we think that at the end of the day, those hierarchies will prove to be negative. So the classic case in history where in a family, where if the man is always viewed as the most powerful person and the woman is less powerful, then that's a negative form of hierarchy that we want to critique, right? But then we look at some of the examples from the past, and one very interesting text is the Kama Sutra, which is the treatise on pleasure from ancient India more than 2,000 years ago. And there it's very interesting because they describe what counts as a kind of legitimate form of, let's say, pleasure between men and women. And it's very explicit that it has to involve shifting hierarchies where there's no one permanent dominant person, who's dominant and who's subordinate. I mean, in the Kama Sutra, I've used kind of pleasure, especially sexual pleasure, as a kind of power struggle. But those power struggles can be justified if they involve shifting roles. Who's subordinate? Who's passive? Always shifting, and eventually becomes a kind of unselfconscious, almost shifting role. And that contributes to, I mean, from the Kama Sutra point of view, to long-lasting pleasure. But we argue that this is a kind of very vivid illustration of what counts as a morally justified hierarchy between intimates. Now, that's the nighttime hierarchies. What about the daytime hierarchies? Well, there we argue, too. They won't be as rapid shifting of roles, so to speak, but they have to be involved shifting roles, whether it's between man and wife. Or the kind of classic Confucian view is that we have age-based hierarchies. And can those be justified in the modern world? And we argue that, well, in a way, they are shifting. It takes a longer time to shift, but eventually the young who are supposed to serve the old become the old, and then they're served by the young. So those are shifting hierarchies as well, which can be justified. We argue there's many other reasons to justify age-based hierarchies. For example, there's lots of social scientific evidence now which shows that typically social skills or emotional intelligence increase with age. And we appeal to some of that evidence. But ultimately, what really justifies age-based hierarchies is the idea that they're not permanent, that they change with over time.
Nice. Well, hey, you guys have provided us, really, both of you have provided us a nice window into the structure of the book and your arguments, which really, with the Chinese political context in mind, your supporting ideas and your personal experiences originate here in China, one thing we've missed, and we probably want to look at. Hey, can you open chapter 3 with a quote from Xunzi, and can you tell us about his importance in the Confucian history?
So, typically in the Confucian tradition, Xunzi is viewed as a problematic character, or he was. Of course, Confucius himself is the most famous and influential thinker in the Confucian tradition, and next most influential would be Mencius or Mengzi in Chinese, who had a view that human nature is good. And that became the dominant interpretation of Confucianism, especially starting from the Song Dynasty. But Xunzi, he was such a deep, profound, and systematic thinker. I think now he's becoming much, much more influential now among those who are reviving the Confucian tradition. The reason why he was marginalized from the subsequent Confucian tradition is that he had this view that human beings, let's say, have a tendency to be bad. And his most famous or infamous student was Han Feizi, who was the kind of systematizer of the very harsh legalist tradition. And in Chinese, legalism means not rule of law, but rule by law, the use of harsh punishment to control people, which justifies an almost very totalitarian kind of society where everybody has to do exactly what they're told according to the detailed regulations. And that was very influential in the first dynasty of China, Qin Shi Huangding, at least the first kind of self-labeled first emperor of China. But that was a very short-lasting dynasty, and he was viewed as too cruel. I mean, he did a lot of what we can say today are kind of good things, like unifying the scripts of China, building an infrastructure, canals and roads, starting to build the Great Wall and so on. But he did it in a very harsh and cruel way. So Xunzi became, let's say, discredited because of this influence on this kind of legalist tradition, which was also discredited in much of subsequent Chinese history, although it was still there in practice to a certain extent. But Xunzi, his view wasn't that human beings are permanently bad. They could be improved through ritual, through literally reading books, through self-education, through this constant effort to progress, as well as being involved in rituals. And his very interesting view is that the rituals are there not to benefit the powerful only, but to benefit those without power. And if you participate in rituals and you take part of those rituals, then it provides a sense of community that binds people together, whether they're powerful or powerless. It gives examples like drinking rituals in a village where first it's the elderly who have more status and power who drink, but eventually everybody else is involved in those drinking rituals and tends to feel a part of the community. And he also applies this to the case of rituals between countries. And so in chapter 3, we argue that the underlying principle that justifies hierarchies between countries is that they're win-win. They benefit both the powerful and the weaker country. It's unlike relations between rulers and citizens, where ultimately they're supposed to benefit the citizens, not the rulers. But if it's relations between countries, then they have to benefit both the powerful countries and the weaker countries. And Xunzi argue that how can you have those win-win relations? One way is to having these common rituals whereby sometimes the weaker countries would, to use language they didn't use, but would pay tribute to the stronger countries. And then in exchange, these stronger countries would provide benefits of some sorts to weaker countries, material and security benefits. And eventually some sort of common values would develop, and there'd be, a stronger form of reciprocity that binds those countries. So we draw on Xunzi to justify this view that we can have weaker and stronger relations between countries. we don't argue for the revival of the tributary system, because obviously that's kind of archaic, and especially the view that China is the kind of center of civilization and all the other countries are somehow backward or more barbarian. I mean, that's hard to accept in the modern era.
And also, it's too expensive for China to
maintain. Right, too expensive to maintain, because the tributary system benefited the weaker countries economically. Yes. That's why they wanted to be part of it. But now they have to be more win-win, where it benefits both China and the weaker countries. So we argue that there's a case to be made for win-win relations between stronger countries, so long as it's not founded on this idea that China is the kind of morally superior center of the earth. But we can have a kind of modified form. I don't want to use the word tributary system, but in the East Asian region, normally the stronger country. Well, okay, let me use another example. I'm from Canada, and I do use this. We do use this example in the book. Canada is a weak state compared to the U.S. And typically speaking, Canada is going to follow the U.S. on foreign policy, on security affairs. So it benefits the U.S., obviously, but it also benefits Canada, because Canada is part of the U.S. security umbrella. They could spend less on the military, more on welfare. So it's good for Canada to be part of this relation. So in the East Asian region, we think eventually China will be viewed as the more powerful country because of its more powerful economy and military, and a certain extent of its cultural influence as well. But if there's a kind of East Asian regional system where it's win-win, where the security and economic arrangement benefits the weaker powers, as well as if there's shared cultural exchanges that provide a stronger sense of community, then that's a good thing. And we should pursue that as a kind of hierarchical arrangement in the East Asian region.
Is that what you're saying, then, that as a possible path to global stability, it's about regional hierarchies?
Right, exactly. Regional hierarchies, where people would recognize that it's a multipolar world with different regions being led by different powers. And of course, there are some common global interests where those stronger powers have to cooperate on climate change. Obviously, global pandemics is a clear case now, nuclear regulation and so on. And AI, too, how to regulate AI. I mean, that's going to be a huge global issue where the regional powers will have to, the most important powers of regional hierarchies will have to cooperate to deal with those issues as well.
Well, we didn't even cover the Tian Sha concept, but it's maybe that's something that the readers can, take on themselves. It's a fairly well known. And as a way to get us, as I mentioned earlier, you guys have done a good job of kind of outlining the book for us. Let me return to the point that, Daniel, you made in the China model, which we mentioned at the beginning of the conversation, because it in some ways does bear repeating, that method matters because the question of which ideals should be used to evaluate the political reality is a political choice, and that it seems like this is more apparent these days, and most of our minds already seem made up regardless of the values in question. My point here is as I hope this is another reason why listeners should become familiar with the new book. And as a final question for you both, it's long been popular to write book reviews on more than a single book with related themes. And these days, many people approach their reading in a similar fashion, that is, searching out books with arguments that complement and challenge and provide a kind of interdisciplinary context. I'm recommending your interesting and readable book to our listeners. So let me ask you, what recommendations would you make for our readers, our listeners, looking to complement and enhance their understanding of your arguments?
I will recommend a book written by my colleague, Professor Bai Tongdong at Fudan University. The name of the book is Against Political Equality. So I think the readers who are interested in our book would also be interested in his book as well. But also I would like to remind readers that he doesn't share the same, we call ourselves progressive conservative. He doesn't share that view with us. He's more like
more of a pure conservative.
He's a conservative.
Or let's say a liberal conservative.
Liberal conservative, yeah. So I would like to remind our readers to take a little bit care of that. But still, it's a very good book. And
It's also published by Princeton University Press.
Published by Princeton University Press this year.
Sure. I'd like to recommend a book by James Hankins. He's probably the or one of the leading Renaissance scholars of our day, professor of history at Harvard, and it's called Virtue Politics. And he shows that in Renaissance Italy, there were all these debates that were kind of that marginalized of late, mainly because of our concerns with democracy and republicanism and so on. But it's debates that are quite similar to, at least in terms of structure, to kind of Confucian arguments about the importance of moral education for rulers, about the importance of being of rulers leading by virtue rather than law. And he wrote this fascinating book published by Harvard University Press where he lays out these debates in great detail. And the final chapter, he also compares it to this to the kind of Confucian arguments about political meritocracy.
Hey, that's great. Thanks for sharing those recommendations. We didn't, maybe in fairness, you guys, in the book, you guys describe yourself as...
progressive conservative.
There you go. And so what does that mean?
Well, on the one hand, we're progressive in the sense that we're attached to what most people consider to be progressive causes, like equality between men and women, reducing income gap between rich and poor, dealing with climate change, with environmental issues. We oppose racism. All those, we can call it left liberal or socialist or Marxist causes, typically we strongly endorse. But on the other hand, we're also conservative in the sense that we value tradition and we think there's a lot to learn from tradition when we think about how to deal with our problems today. And in a way, this idea of progressive conservative, I think it's more natural in a kind of Chinese context where most people, on the other hand, on the one hand, are committed to modernization and socialism and progressive values. But on the other hand, the past weighs so heavily on the present. And not just in a way of like weighing down in a kind of negative sense, but people look to the past for inspiration in a way that wouldn't be so true in Canada where I'm from. That said, there was actually a political party called the Progressive Conservatives, but they were kind of right-wing. That's not what we mean. We just mean that on the one hand, we're attached to progressive values. On the other hand, we strongly value tradition as well. And we think tradition has resources for thinking about how to reform the present, but maybe
And basically, we do this. We call this methodology as a double criticism. We do this examination on like old conceptions, and also we do examination on new conceptions. So it means like we want to examine every conception before we endorse them. So after this double criticism, we would find is it true. Like zeitgeist is a true spirit of times, and we want to follow this, but still we still want to conserve a little bit more. So first we do this double criticism, and after that we do this double affirmation.
And whatever we come up with, it won't necessarily be a universal value, so to speak, because different traditions prioritize different values. So. The different zeitgeist, so to speak, there won't necessarily be one universal one. I mean, we are committed to some universal values. We can call them universal human rights, like we're against torture, we're against slavery, we shouldn't kill innocent people. But beyond that, we should allow for much more diversity, including allowing for different ways of selecting rulers. Much more diversity than typically people, at least in the West, would allow for. And I think this idea of progressive conservative is helpful for thinking about it. Because on the one hand, we are, you know, there are more universal progressive values that we're attached to. But on the other hand, because we're also attached to tradition, there's going to be different plural forms of, let's say, prioritizing values, identity, modernization. Yeah.
Well, political values have I think are back on the... back up front for everybody. So I really appreciate you guys sharing your own values. I think that's a nice way to end our talk about your book. Daniel and Pei, thanks again for your time and congratulations on your new book, Just Hierarchy, Why Social Hierarchies Matter in China and the Rest of the World, just out from Princeton University Press.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for such a close reading of the book.
Thank you.
Take care. Thanks for coming.
Thanks.